The kingdom of heaven may be likened to a king who held a wedding feast for his son. My brothers and sisters, in the book of Revelation, what does St. John the Apostle, the author of that book, how does he speak of Holy Mass? What does he call the Holy Mass? The wedding feast of the Lamb. The wedding feast of our Lord Jesus Christ. My brothers and sisters, in Holy Mass, whom does our Lord come to espouse Himself to? With whom does He long to unite Himself? With you and with me. Why in many churches, especially ancient churches, or basilicas or cathedrals, over the altar, do you find a baldacchino, which is an exact replica of a canopy that you find over a wedding bed with four pillars and a covering over top? That's not by mistake, because the union that takes place in Holy Mass between our Lord Jesus Christ and souls, the highest human representation we can find of that, the greatest analogy, is the union that takes place in a wedding bed. Our Lord says of holy marriage that the two become one flesh. In Mass, our Lord Jesus Christ takes flesh anew to become one with our flesh. You remember St. John the Baptist, when the scribes and Pharisees go out to him, and they say, "Who are you?" And he gives a very strange response. He says, "I am not the bridegroom." He says, "I'm the best man. I'm the friend of the bridegroom. To let everybody know, all of you thousands of people who are coming to me, I'm not the one for whom you were made. It's the one who is to come." Or he gives that very strange, apparently strange, example. He says, "I am not worthy to loosen the strap of his sandal." Why such imagery? In every culture, in every nation, in wedding ceremonies, you have particular customs and traditions. For example, if you go to an Italian wedding, it's going to be very different than a Hispanic wedding or an Irish wedding. I've done many weddings for Hispanic couples, and you'll have the lasso. There'll be the exchange of coins. In an American wedding ceremony, you have the throwing of the bouquet of flowers, the cutting of the cake. One time I was speaking to a theologian, and he said the reason that St. John the Baptist used that imagery, he says, because in a Hebrew wedding ceremony, at least in ancient times, the groom would go to his bride, and he would remove her sandals. John was saying, "I am not the one for whom your souls were made to be united. Our Lord is." One time I was visiting the Carmelite sisters up in Georgetown, about an hour drive from here. And I was speaking to one of the sisters at the end of this meeting with them, and I was talking about some of the struggles as a priest. And one of the greatest challenges at times is to give advice to married couples, right? They come to you, "Father, this is what's going on in our marriage. What do we do?" And so I'm telling the sister all about this. She says, "Oh my God." She breathes a sigh of relief. She says, "Father, one of the greatest things about being a bride of Christ, whenever there's a problem in our relationship, I always know whose fault it is. My spouse is perfect." But I think we oftentimes think that way. Okay, you know, maybe those women who give their lives in that way, yeah, they are the brides of Christ. They were made to be one with our Lord. But really, me? You know, I live in the world. Or especially men. We say, okay, yeah, women can talk that way. But really, a man to be a spouse to Christ, isn't that a little strange? This one time came home to me in a very powerful, concrete way. My dad, the way he raised his sons, he wanted his boys to be tough, right? I want manly sons. I don't want wimps, you know, no crying. I remember when I was just a kid, from my earliest years, he would say something. He repeated this all through my childhood. He'd say, "Okay, Jeremy, you never start a fight. But when you see that a fight's going to come, you make sure you get the first punch." Right? I'd be 3 or 4 years old. You know, you get that first punch. A fight can be decided on one punch. When I was 5, I remember pulling to a stoplight. My dad was driving. I was in the passenger seat. We pull up to a red light. He stops, and there's a man on the corner. And this man had earrings in his ears. Now, in the early 80s, mid-80s, it was not so common to see a man with pierced ears. At least not nearly as common as it is nowadays. My dad looks at me again. I was 5 years old. He says, "Jeremy, you see those things in that guy's ears?" "Yeah, Dad. If you ever come into my house with those things in your ears, I will rip them out of your ears." Okay, so this is my dad. One more. When I was 16 years old, playing sports, football, rugby, I was out lifting weights in my backyard. We had a house with a shed in the back. We had a weight bench there. My closest friends were linemen and linebackers, right? The big guys on the team. We're out there lifting weights. Okay, many teenagers are embarrassed of their parents, as it is. I was all the more embarrassed of my dad because all he ever, I thought, did was talk about God. Right? My friends would come over and be like, "Oh my gosh, Dad, please don't talk about church or God." Or so I have these friends over. My dad's one of those guys who, about every 5 years or so, he gets into the workout mode. Where for about 2, maybe 3 weeks, he'll work out, right? "Oh gosh, I need to get back in the gym." And okay, it lasts a very short time. 5 more years go by. When I was 16, he was not in one of those workout modes. And I'm in the backyard with my buddies, right, wanting to impress them. My dad's mowing the lawn. He comes out to the back shed. I don't know how much weight you lift when you're 16 years old. Maybe we had 185 pounds or 200 pounds on the bench press. My dad comes in. "Hey, guys, throw all the weight you can on there. Let me see what I can max out at." And I go, "Oh my gosh," right? And I start, I'm like, "Lord, please just let him get it once, right? Don't let him embarrass me more." My dad lays down on the bench press. All the weight put on was 285 pounds. He did it 18 times. I mean, he's a freak of nature. So this is my dad, right? This big, strong, manly man. Men don't cry. When I was 20 years old, a lady came over and she was really struggling with her faith. And she's sitting with my dad at the dining room table, a good friend of the family, and I was in the kitchen at the same time. So I could overhear their conversation. And the lady is saying, "You know, I don't understand what's going on. I feel such a distance from our Lord. My whole life, he's been my best friend. Right? He's my brother. Why is this happening?" And I remember my dad said words that I will never forget and that entirely changed my relationship with our Lord. He says to this woman, "I remember what transformed my own relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. He said, it's when I ceased to see him merely as my brother or simply as my friend. And I started to see him as the lover of my soul." My brothers and sisters, do you see our Lord as the lover of your soul? And if you don't, something is missing that ought to be there.
He wants to be so perfectly one with you that there is no separation between you and Him. That He lives fully in you and you in Him. Our souls were made to be espoused to Him. When you receive Holy Communion today, I'd ask a favor of you. And this might be something you've never done before. When you return to your pews and you kneel down to make your thanksgiving, and our Lord is dwelling in you, from the depths of your heart, I would like you to ask our Lord for the grace to see Him as the spouse of your soul, and that you might come to know Him as the lover of your soul. He longs for it. Our hearts will never know true joy and peace until we know that reality. He alone can satisfy us at our deepest levels.